This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Bears, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast focusing exclusively on listener-suggested British murder cases. I'm your host Stuart Blues and this is part 1 of the Season 12 End of Season Special. Before we get into it, let's break the ice. The show's first opening icebreaker segment is this.
True facts that sound like bullshit.
Did you know that hippos have pink milk? The reason is that the hippo secretes two kinds of unique acids, called hipposudoric acid and norhipposudoric acid. One is reddish in colour and the other is bright orange, so when mixed with the standard white milk they produce, it comes out pink. Now it's time for the show's final opening icebreaker segment.
Random quote of the day.
The only way of catching a train I have ever discovered is to miss the train before. That was said by G.K. Chesterton. The case I'm covering in this special has been suggested by 4 listeners, so it's about time I covered it, really. Matthew Street requested it on Instagram, Stephanie Overfield used Messenger, Michelle McFarlane used my website's contact form, and Chris Condon emailed me. We're not in one particular location this week. The crimes I'm about to discuss took place in various locations, primarily in London, so instead what I'm going to do is focus on railways. Railways feature heavily in this episode, so here are 5 quickfire facts about Britain's national rail network. Number 1. The Stockton and Darlington Railway was the first passenger railway to use steam trains to transport passengers. Its first line connected coal mines at Shildon in County Durham to Darlington. Number 2. 3.5 million passengers travel by train every day in the UK, making it one of the busiest railway networks in Europe. That's almost 1.2 billion people per year. Not bad considering our population is just under 68 million. Number 3. There are 40,000 tunnels and viaducts, 9,000 level crossings, 1,100 signal boxes, and almost 10,000 miles of track on the National Rail Network. That's roughly 16,000 kilometres for you metric system users. Number 4. Approximately 70% of UK train journeys either start or finish in London. The busiest station is currently London Liverpool Street, which recently replaced London Waterloo, which was top of the rankings for over a decade. And finally, number 5, Britain's longest railway tunnel, apart from the Channel Tunnel, is the Severn Tunnel at 4.5 miles or 7 kilometres long. As I alluded to at the start, this story will be told across 2 parts. This first part focuses on the women assaulted, raped and murdered by the story's perpetrators, with part 2 focusing on the perpetrators themselves. It's entirely up to you whether you listen to each part as they come out or wait for part 2 and binge them both at once. All I ask is that you listen to part 1 before listening to part 2, regardless of whether or not you wait. My regular listeners will be familiar with these end of season special episodes, but for those of you perhaps listening for the first time, welcome, first and foremost. But let me explain quickly before I get going. At the end of each of my regular seasons, I choose a more notorious case to focus on. Typically, such cases are complex and would last at least an hour if covered in one episode. To keep things bite-sized, I tend to split them up into 2 parts. That's it. One final thing to note is that these episodes heavily focus on the sexual assault and rape of multiple women and children. I've named this 2-parter after the 3 women murdered by the perpetrators. Their stories will be the main focus, but I must stress that there are many others who were also subjected to horrendous acts by the same men. Consider this your content and trigger warning. Please continue listening at your own discretion. The most logical place to start is June 1982, pretty much a year to the day since Peter Sutcliffe was sent to prison for life after murdering at least 13 women and attacking many more between 1975 and 1980. The Falklands War ended that month when the Argentine forces surrendered, returning the islands to British control. 33 pits in South Wales stopped production when 26,000 miners joined the health workers' strikes that had been going on throughout the UK since the beginning of the year. And on June 10th, a young woman was walking on her own along a road bordering Hampstead Heath. It was pretty late that Thursday evening, with reports suggesting the time was around midnight. The 20-year-old was an au pair, which suggests she was not from the UK, but her nationality is irrelevant. It's unclear where she'd been that night, but as she made her way home, she was suddenly confronted by two men who'd pulled up alongside her in a car. Hampstead Heath is North London's iconic green space, and it's incredibly isolated. One can only imagine how frightened the woman must have been when they stopped the car and got out. Before she knew what was happening, the men had overpowered her and dragged her off the road into the darkness and cover of the heath. As far as I can tell, she was the first person raped by the two men, this episode's perpetrators, but sadly, she would be far from the last. It's worth mentioning that others may have been subjected to assaults prior to the 20-year-old but didn't come forward. Given 5 in 6 women who are raped don't report the crime, that's according to rapecrisis.org, I think that's a fair and logical assumption. The same is true for 4 in 5 men, by the way. A minimum of 18 women were attacked, most of whom were raped, throughout London and its various suburbs over the next 12 months, with the majority attacked close to railway stations. One figure I saw in my research was 27, meaning the number of women attacked in total, but as I say, the correct number is likely much higher. With the 20-year-old au pair, my understanding is that her attackers wore balaclavas, as would be the trend with them going forward. Curiously, one of the men was described as being unusually short, with the other being described as tall, although he likely just seemed tall compared to the other and was perhaps of average height. That September, a couple more confirmed attacks were recorded in Golders Green and on Arkwright Road. Each is located roughly a mile from North End Way, the road the 20-year-old was dragged from. The locations are also very close to railway lines, a pattern that would continue for reasons I'll come onto in part 2. The Golders Green attack saw a woman taken by force into the car of two men. On wasteland just off some train tracks, the woman was raped by both of them. Reports suggest initial attempts to rape her failed, hence transporting her in the car to a more secluded area. The Arkwright Road attack occurred just 6 days after that, when a 17-year-old girl was attacked in a frighteningly similar way to the 20-year-old au pair. Whilst walking on her own, she was dragged off the road, away from any potentially prying eyes, and raped by both men. Sunday, October 24th, saw a 22-year-old woman spend the evening at a party in Kilburn, Greater London. After leaving the event, she stopped off for some food at a nearby chicken shop. She was clutching a teddy bear as she left, perhaps winning it or having been gifted it during the party. Unbeknownst to her, the two men, who by this point were on an absolutely abhorrent spree of sexual assaults, had parked their car on a nearby side road and set out on the search for a woman to attack. The term they would later use to describe what they did was hunt. Once more disguising their faces using balaclavas, the men spotted the 22-year-old and approached her, soon dragging her into another isolated side road. It was there where the woman had a knife pulled on her, although at first she thought it was a straightforward robbery, as the men claimed all they wanted was a teddy bear. Attempting to shout for help, she had her mouth quickly silenced as one of the men placed some tape over it. As each of the women before her had, she was then taken to an even more isolated area and raped. In case you're wondering, the reason I'm not mentioning any of these women's names is simply to protect their identity. As 1982 ended and the new year began, the number of reported rapes appeared to suddenly stop that summer. A 29-year-old restaurant manager was attacked by the men as she made her way home from work in March, but as far as I can tell, she was not raped or sexually assaulted. She did her utmost to fight the pair off and was ultimately successful, although she was badly beaten up in the process. The last attack before the sudden stoppage occurred somewhere in South London in July, when a student was approached by a man in the late evening. He asked her what time it was, but the question had no purpose other than to act as a distraction. It allowed his partner in crime to grab the unsuspecting woman from behind and drag her away from the road at knife point. Barren wasteland close to a section of railway line was where he dragged her, whilst the other man kept a lookout. That was what they did. Working in pairs, the two men took turns keeping an eye out for witnesses and making sure the coast was clear before joining in the assault. The student attempted to talk her way out of the situation, but that, along with her attempts to fight back and escape, only angered her attackers. She reported the rape to the police and a police doctor checked her over, but the aftercare she received was reportedly severely lacking. Other than being provided with a morning after pill, she was essentially left to her own devices. She likely felt as though the police were disinterested and went about their business as if nothing had happened. Certain parts of this story I will need to gloss over in this first part because they pertain to the perpetrator's stories. I don't typically focus on the perps as a bit of a rule, but in this case I kind of need to. I'll be taking a deep dive into them next week, so any gaps you've noticed in the story will be filled in then. With that, for reasons I'll come onto in part 2, no further attacks were reported for 6 months. Again, the focus there is on the word reported. It was in January 1984 when the assaults recommenced. A 33-year-old woman was attacked as she made her way to a train station bordering Barnes Common, a local nature reserve in South London. The social worker was taken by surprise by two men, again wearing balaclavas, who took her to an isolated area and threatened her with a knife before physically assaulting her. To prevent her from screaming, they used a rag to gag her before raping her in a wooded area of the common. Between June and July, the attacks appeared to be escalating. A 23-year-old woman was taken hostage in the waiting room of West Hampstead train station before being ordered to walk over to a bridge where she was forced to remove her clothes before being raped. With that attack occurring in June, the next attempted assault I'll discuss took place the following month. A 22-year-old woman was walking alone on a road bordering the east side of Hampstead Heath when two masked men pounced from out of nowhere and dragged her off the road. As they taunted and threatened her with a knife, her screams were so loud that several neighbours said they heard them. She was taken from an area with a much higher residential presence than some of the other women, and because of that, the two men abandoned their planned assault and ran off. Just a week later, two teenagers would not share the same fate as that 22-year-old. The two 18-year-olds were au pairs originally from Denmark, and it was only when they missed their train that they were left with no other choice but to walk up a road that cuts right through the middle of Hampstead Heath. It was very early in the morning, close to 3 a.m. by all accounts, and it wasn't long before they were spotted by two men prowling the area in their car. At that time, the rapists would supposedly play the song Thriller by Michael Jackson on repeat as they drove to hype themselves up, I guess. Having never attacked two women at once before, they were unsure as to how successful they'd be. Their plan was to separate the two teens and for each man to carry out an assault on one of the two. Both of the young women were raped in wooded areas of the heath before being robbed of the small amount of cash they had on them. The TV show Police 5, a programme with a similar concept to Crime Watch, aired an episode shortly after the attack appealing for information about the two masked men, but the calls received on the back of it led nowhere. At some point, possibly in the back half of 1984 or even throughout 1985, it could have been both, the shorter of the two men reportedly began assaulting women on his own. Even so, he continued to attack women with his partner in crime, with an abundance of them taking place in 1985. That January, another au pair, this time a 20-year-old from Germany, was raped by two men after being led at knife point to an isolated area in Brent Cross, Greater London. Just a few days later, they were back at Hampstead Heath, but they ended up running away from the 16-year-old they intended to assault due to the number of people in close proximity. The shorter of the two men later said it was at that point he feared his partner had more malicious ideas in mind and that rape was no longer enough to satisfy his urges. He said he had to physically drag the taller man away from the 16-year-old to prevent them from being seen. A couple of days later, another au pair, a 23-year-old this time, was physically assaulted before her two attackers ran off. It doesn't appear as though they raped her, but she was left with severe bruises all over her face. Her voice is also said to have given way, such was the understandably extreme nature of her screams. Two women were raped on consecutive evenings that March. A 23-year-old was attacked at knife point as she made her way to a local shop, and a 25-year-old was dragged onto Hampstead Heath from the same road the 20-year-old au pair was when the attackers first began their assaults. It wasn't until the evening of the Live Aid concerts on July 13, 1985, that a large-scale investigation was set up in an attempt to catch the two men. Three women were raped that night within hours of each other. One woman was attacked near Great Portland Street Underground Station as she made her way home. Another was attacked on Kentish Town Road, and the third was attacked on Marsden Street. Operation Heart was the name given to the investigation, the largest since the aforementioned Peter Sutcliffe inquiry just a few years earlier. The bizarre thing about all the attacks I've mentioned is that the police were not sure at that point whether there was just one attacker or whether he had an accomplice. The media didn't help as they were dubbing the person responsible for the attacks as the railway rapist, singular. It's at this point in the story where the attacker's intentions finally escalated from rape and sexual assault to murder.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
Alison Day was brought into the world by nurses at Hackney Hospital on May 23, 1966. She was soon adopted by husband and wife Kenneth and Barbara Day, the former of whom worked for the post office. It's unclear why Alison was placed for adoption and who her birth parents were, but the important thing is that she was taken in by a loving couple who may not have been able to have kids of their own. Barbara's health wasn't great during this story's timeline. Kidney problems had led her to receiving dialysis. Going back to Alison and her early life, she attended Gaines School in Upminster, East London, and would later go on to volunteer at a local church after school in her latter high school years to help run a group of Brownies. Brownies are essentially the UK's version of Girl Scouts. Described as an outgoing girl who loved being in the company of others, Alison was incredibly popular and well-loved by those who knew her. She was polite, helpful and punctual, which greatly endeared her to the Brownie unit leaders. Now 19, Alison had a boyfriend called Paul Tiderman, whom she'd been seeing for around 3 years. Paul worked at a printing factory in Hackney called Fairway Graphics and was doing his utmost to put as much money aside as possible to save up for his and Alison's wedding. The pair were deeply in love and had recently got engaged. They just needed to make sure they could financially afford a wedding before setting a date. On the evening of December 29th, 1985, a mere 4 days after Christmas, Paul was asked by his boss to work some overtime due to one of the machines having issues. It would have caused a massive backlog of work that the company could do without, so Paul agreed. Overtime meant extra pay, of course, and phoned Alison to let her know what was happening. Wanting some company, Paul asked her to head to his work, but she wasn't too sure how to get there, having never been before. He reassured Alison that it was an easy place to find and provided her with some detailed instructions that would significantly reduce the possibility of her getting lost. She needed to first get a bus and then a couple of trains before completing the journey on foot. Advised to set off at around 5:30 that evening, Alison did just that. Paul said he'd head out to look for her should she not have arrived by 7. Catching the bus with no issues, Alison soon arrived in Romford. Making it as far as Stratford, Alison questioned a member of staff about how to board the train that would take her to a final destination. That was at 7 p.m, according to the staff member. It'd be the last confirmed sighting of Alison that evening. As she headed out of Stratford station, the two men responsible for the series of rapes over the previous 3 years ran towards her, grabbing her from behind. They'd been keeping an eye out for women on their own for a while before Alison disembarked. Given they had a knife on them, the terrified teenager had no choice but to oblige with their commands. She was forced to walk across the tracks on an isolated portion of the line by one of them, whilst the other acted as a lookout. As they approached a railway bridge, the two men first raped Alison before wrapping a torn piece of her clothing around her neck and using a small stick as a tourniquet. One of the men reportedly shouted out the other's name during the attack. The shorter of the two, whose name was called out, believed the taller man did this on purpose to justify killing Alison. After doing so, her attackers took her body to the nearby River Lee. She had her jacket pockets filled with stones before being dumped in the river. The precise time Alison's body hit the water is believed to have been 8:10 p.m. as the watch she was wearing stopped at that time. Given the last known sighting of her was at around 7 p.m, it means the entire ordeal lasted an hour, during which time Alison was indescribably tortured by her attackers. Paul had gone out looking for Alison as promised and became concerned that he couldn't find her anywhere. He'd contacted Kenneth and Barbara, who came and joined Paul, but after a couple of hours, the decision was made to inform the police. They were called shortly after 9:15. It was at that time Kenneth phoned British Rail to see if they'd reported any incidents on the trains that evening. They hadn't. Alison was being treated as a missing person at that point and would remain so for almost 3 weeks. Searches of the surrounding areas combined with house-to-house inquiries led to nothing. A nearby canal was searched, as was the river, but initially the divers didn't find any sign of Alison. Posters were put up, drivers were questioned and the press were notified, but the case stalled until finally, on the morning of January 15, 1986, Alison's body was found in the River Lee. Her jacket was subsequently found further along the river by chance by the Royal Navy. They were on a training exercise when they made the discovery. Alison's post-mortem, conducted by pathologist Dr. Peter Venesis, revealed her cause of death as being due to material being tightened around her throat using a stick as a tourniquet, a most unusual method of murder. Dr. Venesis said, "A branch was used from somewhere nearby. In addition to this, there was also a knot which had been tied into the ligature around the front of her neck in order to tighten the neck even further. This combination of injuries led us to believe that possibly the person involved may have been someone who knew something about the martial arts, or indeed possibly someone who'd been in the armed forces." That last part may have been mere speculation, but Dr. Venesis had no idea just how right he was. I'll come on to what I mean by that in part two. When Alison's jacket was analysed, several fibres were removed that didn't appear to belong, with the assumption being that they'd come from her killer's clothing. With no suspects in mind, that didn't leave detectives with much to go on. This was in the early 80s too, so DNA was still basically non-existent and the database was a decade away from being introduced. 3 months after Alison's body was found, the two men struck again. Martia Tamboza was a 15-year-old girl who moved to the UK from her native Netherlands when her dad, a civil engineer employed by Shell, moved here for work reasons. The family had moved around a fair bit as a result of his job, but had settled into the Surrey village of West Horsley quite nicely. Born on March 22, 1971, Martia was the eldest of three children to her parents, with her younger siblings being a brother and a sister. Like at least 90% of Dutch people, she spoke English fluently. My research indicates that English is one of the mandatory subjects in schools in the Netherlands, with kids being taught the language from as young as 8. Martia has been described as being a shy girl, but that didn't hinder her popularity with her peers. She was quiet at times, but her smile shone through. She was a happy girl with a bright future. Blessed with intelligence, her family had high hopes regarding what she would go on to achieve as an adult. The close-knit family would often go on bike rides together and used one particular path as a cut-through to the neighbouring village of East Horsley. Although it offered a quick way of getting from one village to the next, it was an isolated path surrounded by woodland. Therefore, Martia's parents advised her and her siblings not to use it should they ever be out cycling alone. It's located just off a main road called The Street, immediately before the railway bridge that crosses it. The path then runs directly alongside the railway line before emerging at East Horsley Village Hall. On Thursday, April 17, 1986, Martia attended school, as she always did, the American Community School in Cobham was where she went, with her studies finishing at 3 p.m. That weekend had long since been in her calendar because she was to visit her home country with her friends on a school trip. Before the day finished, Martia explained that she would be popping to a shop in East Horsley that afternoon to buy some English sweets. The plan was to take them on the trip. Her mum picked her up from school, as was the norm, and upon their arrival at home, Martia explained to her mum where she planned to go and for what purpose. Her mum advised her to stick to the main roads, to which Martia replied that she would, and within an hour, the 15-year-old had set off on her bike. A witness at West Horsley Garage recalled spotting her as she made her way to the shop, because her blue jacket and bright turquoise trousers were items of clothing you wouldn't easily forget. As she reached the railway bridge, Martia decided to take the shortcut route, as the amount of time it would save versus going the long way round via the main roads was astronomical. As she rode along the path, two men suddenly appeared walking towards her in the opposite direction. Thinking nothing of it, she continued to cycle and the two men stepped aside to let her past. The reason for doing so was because the coast wasn't clear enough, one of the men would later say. Figuring the path was likely being used as a through route, meaning the girl would soon return, the two men hatched a plan. As they reached the most secluded area of the path, the taller of the two withdrew some nylon cord from his pocket and set up what was essentially intended to be a tripwire. Tying one end of the cord to a post and the other to a fence that borders the path on one side, the men now lay in wait. It's not clear whether their intention was to use the cord with the intention of the young girl falling off her bike or just to use it as a distraction, but whichever it was, the latter would turn out to be what happened. As Martia cycled home after purchasing the sweet she so longed for, she spotted the crudely placed cord blocking her path and slowed right down until she finally came to a stop just before it. Looking puzzled at the cord, Martia remained on her bike, but within seconds the two men had sprung from their hiding spots and ambushed her. Ordering her to be quiet, the smaller of the two led her away from the path to a wooded area, whilst the taller man wheeled her bike along behind them before discarding it in the nearby woods. Neither man wore a balaclava this time. With their intentions clear, they had no reason to try and hide their identity. Having said that, the two men were nearly caught in the act by a passerby who was walking on the path. As he approached the cord, he simply untied it and continued his journey, none the wiser at the horrors about to unfold just yards away from him. Both men physically assaulted Martia before raping and killing her using the same tourniquet method used on Alison Day. An attempt was then made to burn the 15-year-old's body in a vain attempt of eliminating forensic evidence. Back at Martia's home, her mum was becoming increasingly worried after arriving back at 6:30 p.m. after leaving the house for a brief period. More than a couple of hours had passed since Martia set off, and even if she went the long way round, she should have been home by now. Her mum rang round the parents of her friends to see if she'd stopped off anywhere, to which each person replied they hadn't seen or heard from her, neither had their kids. She then rang her husband, Martia's dad, who was away on business at the time, before finally calling the police. The couple likely discussed what to do next and agreed it was the best course of action to inform the authorities. The local area was searched by police officers with help from Martia's family and friends. Within a few hours, Martia's bike was found in the woods resting against a tree. With the area secured shortly after that discovery at 10:30 p.m, further searches began, but officers couldn't find anything in the darkness. When the search recommenced the following morning, Martia's body was soon found. A couple of locals out hunting rabbits were questioned and informed the officers that they thought they saw a bag of fertilizer in an area of the woods. It stood out as odd because there was no good reason for such an item to be left abandoned there. Before long, officers realized it was not a bag of fertilizer. It was Martia's body. Her hands had been bound using string, and surrounding her badly burnt body were several discarded matches as well as the stick used as a tourniquet. Her subsequent post-mortem, conducted by pathologist Dr. Roger Ainsworth, confirmed Martia died from asphyxia due to strangulation by ligature. Here's the thing though, because the stick used to kill Martia had been placed against her body and was not secured to the material around her neck, detectives at that point didn't make the connection between the method in which she was killed and that which killed Alison Day. They felt the stick was just used to help aid with burning her body. Forensic teams recovered a semen sample from March's body, which pointed to the person responsible for her death being a blood group A secretor. My understanding is that only one of the two men, the shorter one, raped Marcia, with the other being interested only in murdering her. Therefore, only one person was thought to have been responsible for killing Marcia at that point. On the back of discovering her body, Surrey's biggest ever murder investigation was launched. Given the name Operation Bluebell, it saw Guildford Police Station chosen as the place where a major incident room was set up. The biggest piece of evidence for the more than 100 officers assigned to the investigation was the string used to bind Marty's hands. It was a very specific type of string called Somyarn, with the only manufacturer of it being a Preston-based firm called Somic. With the string's origin tracked down, the firm's manager was able to inform the police that the sample they showed him likely dated to 1982, perhaps earlier. Unlike most balls of string, that particular one had come from what's known as an edge strip. This was identified due to the string's width, which was wider than usual. The manager would end up being correct. The string was made from imported paper, a type which the firm hadn't used since 1982. It wasn't something you could just pick up willy-nilly from the shop either. It was sold strictly to those in the trade for industrial purposes. It was thought the completed ball of Somyarn would have been around 9 feet in length, which led to the detectives believing if they found the ball, they'd find the killer. Many good-willed citizens came forward and offered witness testimony, but the lines of inquiry followed ended up being either wholly incorrect or resulted in a wild goose chase. A couple of people said they recalled seeing two men hanging around the isolated footpath around the time Marty was killed, but most of the testimony pointed towards there only being one perpetrator. The vast differences in the descriptions of said men were outrageous to say the least. When Crime Watch featured Marty's story in May, a month after her murder, it led to many viewers calling in, as is typical with such shows. Unfortunately, of the 150-plus calls made, not one offered anything concrete or reliable. Soon enough, the murders of Alison and Marty were linked due to the undeniable similarities between them. The two respective pathologists who conducted their postmortems agreed the method of killing in particular was of note due to how unusual it was. Clothes had also been ripped in both instances, and samples recovered from both scenes pointed towards a male with blood group A secretor. Before long, the nation's biggest manhunt since Sutcliffe had begun, with the three forces working on the rapes, Alison's murder and Marty's murder joining forces. With that, Operation Trinity was launched. Just a month after killing Marty, the two murderers struck again. Their third and final murder victim, that we know of, was a 29-year-old woman called Anne Locke. Born on June 11, 1956, Anne married her boyfriend Lawrence Locke, a 26-year-old meat importer, on April 19th, 2 days after Marty was killed. Having left school at 18 and taken up secretarial work for a couple of huge TV studios, including the BBC, Anne met Lawrence after the pair bonded over their mutual love of swimming. A couple of years before the wedding saw Anne living solely with her grandma after losing her last remaining parent. Both of them lived with her and her gran prior to that. Once married, Anne had her grandma move in with her and Lawrence at their home in Brookmans Park, Hertfordshire. Anne worked for London Weekend Television during this story's events and had not long returned from her three-week-long honeymoon in the glorious Seychelles. On Sunday, May 18th, Anne was asked to work, which meant she had to sacrifice accompanying her new husband on his scuba diving trip to Dorset. Arriving at work close to 5 p.m, Anne finished what she needed to do at around 8:30, which wasn't ideal as she had only planned to be there for a couple of hours, but the work wasn't going to do itself. As Anne's train pulled into Brookmans Park just after 10 p.m, she was grabbed from behind by two men and informed not to scream as they had a knife. They had been laying in wait at the station due to a woman having left a bicycle there earlier in the day. Their plan was to wait for her to return, but upon seeing Anne on her own, they took their chance. Anne had her own bike, which she'd kept locked in the station shed, and it was there where they pounced. Walking her to a secluded area, the men assaulted and raped Anne before killing her. Meanwhile, back at home, her worried grandma informed Lawrence when he got back that Anne hadn't returned, which led to him swiftly heading for the station. Anne was nowhere to be seen, nor was her bike. Early the following morning, the bike was recovered from a fence close to the shed, less than 100 yards away. Its padlock had been used to secure it there. With the police informed, searches for Anne began, and her case, although classed only as a missing person one at that point, was featured in a small capacity on an episode of Crime Watch. With nowhere else to turn, detectives took to questioning Lawrence as a possible suspect. It's typical for those closest to you to be the ones responsible for something bad happening, but it wasn't the case here. Tracker dogs were brought in to help aid the search efforts, but it led to nothing. Eventually, Paul Dockley, part of the newly dubbed Operation Swallow, stumbled across Anne's address book as he walked along a path next to the railway line. Soon enough, her diary was found, and finally, 9 weeks after she disappeared, Anne Locke's body was found on July 21st. Railway workers made the discovery that afternoon. She was lying in thick undergrowth on a railway embankment. Her body was so badly decomposed after being out in the elements for that long that Anne could only be identified by her dental records. Her cause of death was confirmed as being asphyxial suffocation due to gagging. She'd had a sock shoved down her throat and suffocated as a result. Like Martia, Anne's body had been burned and her hands were also tied behind her back. The Somyarn wasn't used this time, however. The killers opted to use tape instead. Once more, semen recovered from Anne pointed to the perpetrator being the same man responsible for killing Alison and Martia due to being a blood group A secretor. With all three murders now linked, the investigation was the first to utilise computers to log everything. It was essentially an early version of the Home Office Large Major Inquiry System, better known by the acronym HOMES. Operation Heart, the investigation tasked with trying to catch the person responsible for the series of rapes, had a list of known sex offenders totaling almost 5,000, which they dubbed the Z-Men. Male number 1,594 on that list was a 30-year-old Irish-born former British Rail worker who had previously been arrested after assaulting and raping his wife. His name was John Duffy. And that concludes part one of this story. Thanks again, Matthew, Stephanie, Michelle and Chris for requesting it. I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts. This week's new reviews are as follows. Angelica Seedorf left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, I listen to many crime podcasts and I have my favourites. Since last week, British Murders are in my top 3 listening choices. I can't stop listening. Keep on doing what you do, Stuart. Paul Smith left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, Hi Stuart, love your podcast. Can you cover the murder of Carl Bridgewater? It was a horrific case and it's local to me. Thanks, keep up the good work. That case is on my list already, Paul. I've now added your name to it. Kathy Worthing left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, Great show. I don't like unsolved cases, so this podcast hits the mark. Great accent. And finally, Cassie Wynne left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, I love all true crime podcasts, but gotta say, yours is my fave. Good work. Thank you, Angelica, Paul, Kathy, and Cassie for leaving those reviews. If you want to leave a review of the show and have it read on a future episode, you can do that on iTunes, Facebook, Podchaser, or BritishMurders.com. You can also leave star ratings on Spotify. Why not join my Patreon community? patreon.com/BritishMurders. If you sign up for an OBE or CBE tier, you'll get several perks on there. Ad-free episodes, access to bonus episodes, access to my weekly journal series, exclusive giveaways, and thank you goodies for signing up. Hello and welcome to my newest Patreon member, Erin Peck. If you want to support me on a one-off basis, you can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/BritishMurders. Thank you, Michelle Daoud, for buying me 3 beers on there. I always say your name wrong, Michelle, sorry. The message left was, I've been listening to the podcast for about a year now. I love Stuart's delivery style and I like the interviews very much. It's well researched, it's lovely to listen to and very interesting, and I think you deserve a treat. Thank you. Please continue emailing case suggestions to contact@BritishMurders.com or message me via social media. You'll not only get the episode covered, but you'll get a cheeky shout out for your trouble. And that does it for another episode. I'll be back with part 2 next week. I've been Stuart Blues. This has been British Murders. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, cheerio.